did.
Okay.
Oh, go to Snapchat.
Good afternoon, everyone. It is 4:34 p.m. and we do have a quorum, so we're going to get started briefly. First off, we do have pizza, so please feel free to help yourself if you'd like anything. Second, first on the agenda would be a minutes, the adoption of the minutes. They have not been provided to us, so we are going to table those until the spring. I also like to take the moment to welcome Professor Claire Petrel, who's a university hearing board chair who has been kind enough to join us this afternoon. We will be actually turn to you at just a moment after we do a quick recap, and you'll have the floor. So in terms of end of semester outlook, this is our last meeting of the semester. Thank you very much for coming. It's been a very busy semester. I was telling you before we started that this semester alone, we have met over three times as much as we met the entirety of last year. And I know that it's taxing on everyone's time and just and mental resources. So I wanted to personally thank everyone for the work they put in. I think we've had a very productive semester. We have a lot of work left to do, but we don't necessarily often say thank you enough. And I want to personally thank everyone on the committee for their hard work. It's been a busy semester, but I think we've done great work. Also, I wanted to tell the assembly that our telecommittee, pardon me, that Sarah Park, the SA, one of the SA's representatives, has resigned from the committee effective as of a week or so ago.
She did.
Sarah Park?
She did.
Yes. So she said she was otherwise busy or otherwise engaged and said that in the interest of having someone who was able to attend more frequently, she has resigned. She's been on this committee for, I believe, 2 years. So I have expressed my gratitude to her for her service and wanted to recognize her for that. In terms of also the University Assembly had the complaints advisors come and give an update yesterday. We're hoping to have them come in the spring and talk to this committee. There's a number of specific items that they're looking for that they think the Assembly could help them provide in terms of ensuring they have resources and recognition similar to the JCC. There's a resolution currently on the UA's floor asking them to be confirmed by the UA, but we are going to have a second resolution hopefully coming through this committee in terms of looking for specific items that we can utilize to advocate on their behalf. I've actually worked closely. The complaints advisor are law students, so I happen to know a number of them. So we're hoping to be able to help them out as they do important work. We also have the UHRB staffing, which was the questions are in this case. I have a couple of ideas in terms of the hypothetical, but otherwise the questions are relatively done. They will, and I'm meeting with Gina DeMatista, the director of the Office of the Assembly, is next, I want to say Monday, to hammer out a timeline. As I said before, the GLSS Institute is that underway. We'll talk more when we get to that on the agenda. But in general, the items that are, some of them have been sitting on our agenda for a while. We're hoping to get those in spring, as well as hopefully working with the complainants advisor. That is where we are. And then I am very happy, as I said before, have Professor Claire Futrell. I'm so sorry. But thank you so much for coming. She is a review board, hearing board chair, and we unfortunately, a number of your colleagues couldn't make it, but we're so glad you could. And in essence, this is just for a chance for you to tell us how the hearing boards are operating, if you have anything you've seen or observed over your time of service, and anything that we could do to help or otherwise changes you could recommend or otherwise provide, and also question time for Q&A.
I'm probably the worst one to have here because I'm very new as a chair, and so I actually haven't done anything apart from attend the odd meeting to discuss what chairs do. So. I'm afraid I really can't offer you anything. As far as I know, everything's happening smoothly. I haven't heard any concerns there, but thank you for
your Well, thank you so much. As I said, there's a number of other hearing board chairs, there's a review board chair, an administrative chair. Unfortunately, none of them could attend, even though I emailed them considerably in advance of this meeting. We're actually likely going to reschedule them for some time in the spring, so we can actually have an update from, I mean, thank you so much for coming.
Well,
in terms of people who have run hearings, we can actually have a discussion. In terms of on our meeting, we attached the hearing board policies, as well as who's who in the display system, which actually is courtesy of Michelle. I actually did tweet that, and Mr. Sisney has the administrative chair. But that being said, if anyone has, we do have time allocated. If anyone has any questions about the hearing board procedures or policies in general that we can talk about amongst ourselves, obviously I can make notes and we can bring them back in the spring. Yes, and you are welcome to stay, have pizza, part of your convenience. Thank you so much.
Okay. If you think it would be useful, I'm happy to stay since I've walked all the way down.
Absolutely. Well, in that case, yes.
But if there aren't
Absolutely. Well, this is one item on our agenda, and after that, you are welcome to, if you're interested, you're always welcome to remain. If not, okay, thank you so much for taking the time to come. So in that case, are there any, Richard?
So there were three questions that came up actually last spring in connection with the hearing board and one of the cases. My understanding as chair of the hearing board is can deny to a defendant the participation of legal counsel in the proceedings. It is also, there was also the chair of the hearing board can deny or arrange a public hearing in a case. And the third one is that the chair of the hearing board can deny the defendant witnesses. And those, in the case that I'm thinking, those were all fairly contentious issues. And I myself, looking at that case and wondering in general about procedures, that if the defendant wants legal counsel, that's in the participation, that should be a right. That if they want a public hearing, the board should be at a place where that public hearing can take place. It happened last spring.
They got moved,
and the facilities didn't work. So it was basically a denial. And the third is that the defendant has the right to call witnesses and not to have those. I was, in fact, one of the witnesses who was excluded by the hearing board chair last spring. So those are basic issues. I don't see them addressed particularly in this document. And you are new to this thing, so I'm not.
And I wasn't one when that happened. I read about it in the Sun.
Of course, so I'm just bringing them up as issues that I think they're still live issues because those things happened in the past and were asserted as prerogatives. So those are concerns.
And I think that my co-chairs probably have some answers to this. I think the open hearing thing, I think I'm right in saying on their behalf, as I say, this isn't something I was directly involved with. I think they would have liked to have made it more open. I think it was not realizing how many people were going to arrive, moving it to somewhere that still wasn't big enough.
And it didn't work.
I think that was unfortunate. Everybody recognizes that it was unfortunate. My understanding of right to counsel is a concern that the university judicial system isn't sort of organized so that it has lawyers who come in and make, I don't want to say glib arguments, but I mean they try and make it a bit more sort of friendly and amenable to people. And so that I think might be sort of the reason why reluctant to have counsel. I think it have counsel, I think counsel can't speak, is that correct?
That was the problem.
Yeah.
Yes, I'm in favor of friendly and amicable proceedings.
Yeah.
This proceeding was not particularly friendly or amicable, and it looked like, my student. It looked like a vendetta on the part of, that's my interpretation, a vendetta on the part of the university administrator. So it was not in any way,
Okay, was that case?
Didn't appear to be that thing. But that's not the point exactly. I mean, the point exactly is about these procedures and having the chair of the university hearing board able to deny what I think are should be basic rights.
Well, as I said, my understanding of the right to counsel is that they have the right to counsel, but the counsel doesn't participate in the, I think they can be there, can't they, but they can't actually participate.
or that was the ruling. That's, yes. I don't see that in this document. Yeah. So that was a discretionary ruling on the part of the hearing board, rather than being a, you know, something that was in this document that was implied.
And the right to call a witness, I can't comment on that because I don't remember the details of that. I would be, we're having a meeting, I believe, with the JAA in sometime in the new year, and I'd be happy to raise those issues with the other chairs.
Thank you. And as I mentioned, we're hoping to find another time when we can get more of the chairs who are able to
get. You may get the person who is involved.
Yes, exactly. And in terms of for the committee looking at the general, or looking at the code, right now the procedures of the hearing board are internally adopted, published in the Cornell Chronicle for 30 days before they become effective. There was a suggestion made in this last spring to perhaps look at something similar to, again, looking to analysis, the federal rule of civil procedure, where in essence the hearing board proposes that in addition to being published in the Chronicle, it would be brought to the CJC. In essence, if the CJC took no action, it would automatically become operable in 30 days or some way to, in essence, ensure the committee is aware of what is of the procedures going on. They haven't been updated in a number of years, so therefore we haven't had occasion to look. But that is something for the committee to consider. Also, next on the speaker is Michelle.
I just want to take a couple minutes to kind of to maybe answer some of the questions you have, Richard, and kind of talk about some of the things that I'm hoping that the University Hearing Board chairs might look at when they look at these provisions. So the first thing that I think we need to remember is that this is an educational administrative process. This isn't a courtroom. We don't use rules of evidence. There's a basic fundamental fairness that has to be met. But we don't use things like evidence. We call it information. We don't call people defendants. They're respondents. They're not found guilty. They're found responsible because we're not a court of law. We have very different objectives. So I think we first have to remember that. And so some of the things that you brought up, Richard, are really balancing those equities. And so, for example, the right to confront witnesses. That's actually a code provision. It's not a hearing board procedure that talks about the right to confront witnesses. The chair also has to decide, is there going to be a balance to the witness and the cause and the harm that's caused there? So we look at somebody who was hazed is probably a great example. We had some cases where we've asked that witnesses provide statements that the other party has the right to submit questions to as well, because the trauma of being cross-examined by an attorney is not something we want to put our students in the place to. So we're balancing that. Both of these are community members. The code actually says that lawyers can only participate in cases of suspension or dismissal, but the judicial codes counselors can participate fully in every proceeding. And so that's something that we have to balance too, and that's something that's the code has been dictated. I think it's important to remember that the judicial administrator doesn't write or write the code or the hearing board procedures. We just follow it. And so many changes that you're suggesting are things that you have to go through either the hearing board procedures and kind of go through there, or the code procedures. But I think we really have to remember that this isn't a courtroom. We don't put people in jail. We're not depriving them of their liberty. The worst we can do is say, you can't work, teacher, or study at Cornell. I think the other thing we really have to remember, just at a different point about public hearings, I've already spoken with Gabe and Matthew that if there is another public hearing, that the University Assembly would pay for the entire cost of that, because I don't have a budget for that. And so we've done some cost analysis, and public hearings are going to be somewhere around $10,000 per public hearing. To get into the space where it's completely issue. And they issue that because there's no way to know in advance. So things like Harmon Hall needs 6 months in advance of us. We wouldn't have that. So we would have to book a room at the Statler, one of the conference rooms, and for the short notice is looked at about $10,000 per cop. So I have had that conversation that is a code provision that we're asking for assistance of people want to make it. So I just really want to, again, put the point that and we have to balance these equities because we're in an educational setting and not a courtroom.
And just actually, in terms of just very briefly on the monetary aspect, we have had that conversation. I also actually after that spoke with informally with the dean of students in the law school. In terms of if that comes up, in terms of the law school, so they have their rooms, they would be able possibly able to bring up. In terms of so that would be the UA has a surplus that we, in essence, Mr. Kaufman has said that we'd be willing to certainly utilize for this aspect because it is important. But that being said, there is also, we've also looked at steps in terms of, okay, assuming that it's, we assume we have more than 5 hours notice, which we always would have, you would be able to hopefully find other rooms on campus and work with them to minimize costs. But that being said, you are correct that open hearings, like everything else, comes with a cost. Next on the speakers list is Nate.
So I have a comment on these rules and also a comment on how they're implemented. A comment on the rules is that, you know, I very much support the idea of the UHR, the process as an educational process with an educational goal where everybody is a member of the community from start to finish. I think there are a lot of places where these rules can be a little bit less court-esque. It's a familiar paradigm for some of us, and it's easy, and I don't know who wrote these, but I suspect Kevin Claremont had a hand in it, as he did with most of the university's adjudicated rules and procedures. But one thing that jumped out at me is that I actually don't see the word, I see evidence used, not information, throughout these, and so, and actually reference to the rules of evidence. I don't know which rules of evidence those are. Federal, New York State doesn't have them codified, but you know, the less of that maybe we can have, the better. That might be a place to look at focusing, but I think throughout these rules or these procedures do a good, but maybe could do a slightly better job of avoiding legalism and going more for this sort of community-oriented rehabilitative approach. The implementation comment that I had is that there's a whole section on removal of panel members and on neutrality and dispassionate nature of the panel members. And it sounds like maybe that wasn't fully adhered to in the case of Mitch McBride. If it seems from Rich, from what you're saying, I may have misunderstood you, but it sounded to me like you were saying that there were concerns that the actual UHB members might have had a vendetta against Mitch. And if that's the case, oh, okay, then I misunderstood.
You said administration.
No. Oh, okay. Your administrator who pressed the case.
All right.
Absolutely. When hearing board members come and pick up their packets, they actually have to sign a statement saying that they are adhered to this level of non-commitment of fairness. So there's a check on it that gets sent to the chair as well.
Thank you. Next, introduce Susanna.
Thank you for coming here today. I think I have some follow-ups from Richard. I was also in the, overflow room. Not overflow room, because we weren't in the same room as the hearing for McBride's case. But
you couldn't hear there, is that correct?
Yeah. No one could, whatever. That was a technical glitch that can be sorted out for next time. What came up there is that the Sun reporter and I were both live tweeting with the permission of the person managing that room. And then halfway through, it came to the attention of the hearing board that some of us were live tweeting. And that had to be discussed as to whether or not that was a violation, where we tried to clear it in advance, because I personally did not want to get JA'd. I noticed in this that decorum involves no taping, no tape recording. There is no exemption for public hearings. When it goes to the rules on public hearings, if the respondent chooses one, there's no exemption for tape recording. And it seems to me that's something that should be considered, or at the very least, there need to be very clear guidelines on how both journalists and students can share, disseminate whatever information from that public hearing. Because that was certainly an interesting moment where it's like, oh, whoops. But the Sun reporter wasn't sure how he should be covering this at that point, and it looked really bad for transparency.
Excellent speaker list. I have Risa and then Richard.
This is about the issue of, I mean, we've had this discussion before in different ways, you know, the issue of is something educational as opposed to more adjudicative. And, you know, I'm of a mind that I like procedures. I like procedures that are clear. I like procedures that actually try to give due process and that we don't pretend that there's a certain level of educational purpose to doing this that doesn't exist. I mean, education's fine. If people are educated through this, I guess that's good. But it's also, there is punitive, there's a punitive nature of it. Just because you're not deprived of your liberty, you know, doesn't mean that it's not punitive. And the phrase in labor law, especially like in arbitration that we use, is that termination or discharge is the industrial form of capital punishment. And there's something to be said for that in terms of, you know, it is actual punishment that's very, very severe. So if you don't, if you're not able to study here, if you're not able to work here, if you're told, you know, if you risk potential suspension or termination, that's really serious. And so due process and clarity of due process and calling things what they are, it's evidence, all right? It's not just information, it's evidence. Cross-examination, if it's going to be allowed, we need to be clear. So I'm all in favor of clarity and providing for due process and for making sure that, you know, if you're the hearing board chair, if you're on the hearing board, that you're sufficiently educated in it so that, you know, people come from different disciplines and they need to feel comfortable in recognizing that there is something to this due process that, you know, really has a unique quality, right? It isn't just sort of general fairness. So, you know, I'm just not for this thing of pretending that this is just educational. It is not. And so if we take that seriously, then we can have education where it's helpful in the process, but also not sacrifice the fairness that comes from, you know, due process that fits the setting, even if it's not the same as in, you know, whether it's civil or criminal proceeding. The other thing, Nate, you had mentioned about rehabilitation, and there's nothing inconsistent between rehabilitation as a purpose and providing due process. Right? I mean, we have people talk about rehabilitation in the criminal law process, and of course, U.S. has done a very terrible job of, you know, rehabilitation or habilitation to begin with, but you know, we can think about rehabilitation and due process. We're not having to choose; they're not mutually exclusive at all.
Thank you. Just the one thing I will note is this: members of this committee in the past have also had like an expulsion to the equivalent of the academic death penalty.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Excellent speakers is Richard, then Michelle, and then Nate.
Yeah. So Risa just said more eloquently most of what I was going to say. It is the penalty and rehabilitation. That's another issue with due process and penalties. The case I'm thinking of though is even more egregious. The night before the hearing board met on the McBride case, the provost wrote an open letter to the Sun, and it was published, endorsing the senior administrator, clearly indicating an endorsement, though it is implied, endorsement of her action and of the content of her charges, that in no way was this timely, this timely intervention accidental. In no way it was a premeditated intervention to bias the proceedings. The problem in something like that is it's not a rehabilitation, it's a lynching. And you know, what we have to be aware of is in a case involving, and as this one did, a senior administrator, very senior administrator at the university, and just, you know, an undergraduate, the disproportion in power, in ability, resources, manipulation of public opinion, everything is so extreme. The hearing board, I mean, it's outside the hearing board,
ability to make that good. But one of the things to understand is that those kinds of interventions, those kinds of behavior on the part of the administration, those should be condemned. They shouldn't be just, it's just noise in the background. It is wrong. And so it's, in some ways, you know, those kinds of I don't know how to deal with it except through public opinion. I mean, certainly I thought the provost's charges and interventions were in some ways violation of the code itself, though I'd have to really look and find a place for it. But I thought they were far more serious than anything that Mitch McBride had done. One of the things we need to do, and the hearing board is part of this because it's a pivot in the whole complex of things, is to equalize the standing of all members of the university community, the standing of resources available to them when they confront situations like this. And that's the reason why legal counsel, public hearing, and witnesses are important. And this poor undergraduate, fighting a penalty in the university hearing board in the midst of a situation where the provost is marshaling public opinion against him. This, you know, these decisions on the part of the hearing board, they're not isolated from the broader context. The procedural rights that I've noted and recent described, those procedural rights, they're only a minimum of what you would do in a situation like this. They're not, it isn't the case that the hearing board is somehow separate or an island in the middle of the ocean and nobody else is paying attention. This was a problem. And that's the reason why the equalization of resources procedurally is far more important than as well.
Thank you, Richard. Next is Michelle.
I agree kind of what Richard said about the idea of publicity and stuff like that. And I think, and I haven't had the opportunity to show this, but that's why our office makes no comments either way, because we're just, our job is to administer. I think I can clarify in that case that we did have a report that was issued to our office, but it was within their workspace. So we don't have jurisdiction over faculty or staff in the course of their workplace. And that was public information, so I'm not disclosing anything that wasn't there. So hopefully that'll save you some research. You know, I think when we talk about rehabilitation, 99% of our cases, the individual remains on campus. So if we were this punitive system, we would have a zero tolerance policy. And some campuses do. Some campuses have, you know, you look at the equivalent of University of Virginia, their academic, one dishonesty, you're completely done. You look at a Brigham Young, right? You have one sip of alcohol, you're gone from the university. And so I think we need to be really careful when we say that we're not a restorative system, because 99% of our cases are restorative. And y'all don't get the opportunity to read some of the letters that the students sent to us in their reflection papers, but they're amazing. And we can pull some if that's something helpful, but they talk about, you know, I'm grateful for this because it actually showed me that I was making poor decisions. Or, you know, I didn't realize the fact that I punched someone was going to have this sort of impact on them. And so I actually think we are really restorative in a lot of the senses, because you look at the numbers, and we provided this for the data for our last meeting, our dismissal and our suspension rate is just extremely small. When we talk about equity, I think one of the things that we're really forgetting when it comes to equity is, imagine if you're an 18-year-old student, you get this document. This is awful to read. It, as Anna mentioned, it contradicts itself. The idea about the public hearing stuff is because the code overrode the procedures, because they haven't been cross-referenced, and it's been piecemealed, and so that's why I'm very hesitant when we talk about making changes piecemeal. I think we're just going to keep running into these issues. And so one of the things that I would really challenge the university hearing boards is to emphatically say, if you were an 18-year-old student and you got these hearing board procedures, could you make heads and tails of it? Because I don't think so. And the fact that our system is so complex that we require an extra 15 pages trying to explain how the proceeding goes is really disproportionately fair. I think the other thing, yeah, I know it's just a small terminology, but we're a private university, and our university council has specifically fought to undo that, because if we were a public institution, there's certain things that we have to follow. So when we talk about due process, that's not applying to us. We just have to meet a fundamental fairness standard. So I think we need to be really careful with that, because that term of art really does affect some of the legal aspects that we would have to fight. So, yeah, but again, I just want to reiterate the fact that 99% of our students in response are remaining on campus. They're getting learning, they're getting the skills that they were deficient at the time that they made those decisions. And about 97% never interact with our office again, unless it's a voluntary capacity, because they want coffee or come in and chat with us.
Thank you, Michelle. And just one thing in terms of Richard's point about the administration commenting upon the dependency of proceedings. That is, Michelle's, I thought you were gonna bring up, this is why I stayed out, but the code does in essence say if it's in the workplace, it's not covered. That being said, the UA could, if the UA was concerned, could pass a resolution, could ask the president to issue a directive. I mean, in essence, there are other ways outside of through the standard UA resolution process to seek action if the assembly feels it is, or the committee and assembly feel it's something that's worth pursuing. There are ways to, in essence, if the president were to issue a directive to not comment upon these dependency of proceedings, it would, in theory, again, just be the same as the president issuing another directive, so that would hopefully have some effect. That means that is a longer discussion that I hope we'll be able to have when we have more of the hearing board chairs here in the spring. Next speaker is Nate and then Anna.
Yeah, I was actually going to suggest that we consider a resolution from here to the UA asking the administration not to comment on pending cases. I do want to be clear, I don't think I said that there is any kind of fundamental incompatibility between good process, I'll say rather than due process, and rehabilitative goals. I think it is a good point that the university process is fundamentally somewhat punitive in nature. It's also somewhat educational, somewhat rehabilitative, somewhat restorative, you know, somewhat deterrent, right? Like, pick a theory, and it works toward that end to some degree. I think the point about the I'm also generally pro process, and Richard, I want to be very clear that I agree with you that good, intelligible, fair process is something that people are due, and yet one of the risks of using legal language is that it gets misused, and due process is a term that, as Michelle says, is not binding on the university. We should have process. It should be good. It should be what is owed to students, but it's not due process. So it seems like one of the big takeaways here is definitely clarifying this language. And some of that means facing up to where the code in the UHRB process really is punitive, and where it really is educational, and where it really is rehabilitative to victims, or rehabilitative to offenders or restorative to victims. And so I don't know where, you know, which parts do which things, but we should figure out more clearly which parts do which things and make the language reflect that. Because, right, to some extent, yeah, if somebody punches somebody else, then there has to be some kind of semi-punitive consequence for that. I think it's a little bit needlessly hyperbolic to refer to expulsion as the death penalty. Having done death penalty work and worked with people who have done death penalty work, it's worse to be killed than to be expelled from the university. But it's a big deal. We need to be honest about when we levy these large, you know, hefty, grave consequences against people. And, you know, on the other hand, we also have to be frank with people when what we want them to take away is not never do this again, but here's the effect of your actions on other people. So I think clarity of language and clarity of goal are definitely where to look.
Next set up.
I'm going to push a little, and I'm not sure whether we're going to agree at the end of this or not. You're saying that McBride should have had fuller access to legal counsel throughout the process, if I'm understanding you right, among other things.
Unrestricted
access to legal counsel. And I would urge us to move towards a system where no one has that access to legal counsel from outside the university, because that is something that is going to disproportionately
advantage students from well-off backgrounds. And the amount that McBride's family paid, whether or not they should have had to or actually had to, is a burden that they shouldn't have had to pay. Even as I'm saying this, even as I'm saying I want us to move towards a system where external legal counsel is not necessary, and that may be a humanities daydream of mine. I am open to being shot down hard here. It certainly seems like right now that's not a situation that is on the ground because of the pressures you're mentioning from administration, because of the way that the system's currently working. So I would like this as an eventual goal, unless I'm being really dumb here. And I'm not saying I want this as an immediate goal.
Thank you. And I just, Kendall Carr, the JCC, couldn't attend this meeting. Actually, I had a conversation about the Herringbird procedures with her predecessor, Adibal Olafan, last semester, and actually in years prior as well. And they have said numerous times in public meetings, from their point of view, they don't have outside counsel actually to be a liability to a respondent, because and the way they have said it is that the JCCs have an incredible working knowledge of the code. By the time, assuming this is a quote unquote marquee case, right, a large case that's going to be taken by the JCC or the other third year law students at JCC, in that case they've generally had a year or two of experience. And in terms of, they said they spend a lot of their time bringing in outside counsel up to speed, which actually is deleterious to providing a case. We have outside counsel trying to make all of these motions or try to do, in essence, to follow these strict rules of federal evidence or New York State's more common law rules of evidence. So that's something that they have always said, that in essence they say, the JCCs, and obviously they're the ones saying this, but they always say that they feel that outside counsel actually doesn't really help, because the JCCs are the ones who, A, can speak, B, have the incredible experience and the working relationship to understand not only how Cornell system works, but how the hearing boards tend to work and how everything else tends to work. Me and Kendall's not here. I figured the committee might find it prudent. Next.
We have a situation in which, whether or not it was helpful, this family felt it necessary, and that's a problem.
Next, I have David, then Risa, then Richard.
Two questions. One is, who is in charge of the CHP document?
That would be the hearing boards themselves.
Okay. Then the second question is, who can recommend that the owner of the document revise it and clarify it so that the questions that we're having in this conversation are taken care of, because it's been 4 years since it's been revised.
Absolutely. I'll take that as my information. The hearing board themselves, they control the document. They are they are required per the document, I believe also the code, to meet at least once a year to contemplate any revisions. Mm-hmm. If they were to discuss and adopt revisions, they would then be promulgated publicly in the Cornell Chronicle for at least 30 days, upon which they would then become active. I referenced earlier, there was talk last year, and very briefly this year, about potentially making it so the CJC has a more role in terms of formally recommending, or a more interactive role in terms of trying to ensure there is a congruity. There was actually, for the hearing last year, I personally could not locate a copy of these procedures actually at Hegel. So Michelle was very kind and got them to me almost immediately. But in terms of, I was hard to locate them, and that was something, to be blunt, which the committee said was emblematic of, in essence, the idea that there needs to be communication. And I know the JA's website was under renovation, and the JCC's website is actually thinking that it's a resource issue for them. But in terms of making sure these are more widely available and more congruent, that's why there was talk of potentially having the CJC, in essence, have more of a conversation. Well, that's actually also why we have the hearing board chairs here now, and that we've lost over the years with busyness and less frequent meetings, things tend to fall through the cracks, and this was something that was on our radar, but after seeing the McBride hearing, became, as in say, very much like the JCCs were 3 or 4 years ago, saying, okay, we need to look at this, we need to look at relatively
frequently. So the process is moving now?
The process is moving, yes. This is the process.
Right. Is it Andrew, or is it your who says the chair's responsibility? Is it Andrew's?
I don't know. I apologize. I don't. We have a.
That's right. Can you help?
So do I want to add?
I've asked the administrative chair that this project's for the spring semester to.
So that's something we'll be discussing.
Yeah, with the JCCs.
And for those who don't know, that is Joel Sisney. He was the individual. Yes, he was reelected. He was the individual who actually moderated the out the remote room for the McBride hearing. My interactions have always been cordial, been very, very wonderful to work with. So I'm hopeful that that will continue abreast. But in essence, did that answer your question, David?
That's fine. Thanks.
And next, we have Risa and then Richard.
Yeah, just going back to that, some of the points that have been raised. Number one, I think it's great if we have successful restorative justice. I think it's terrific. It seems to me that the question here is when you need to have a hearing, what should the hearing be like in terms of process? And, you know, there may well be other ways, there may well be ways to adjust language in certain ways to make it sort of more accessible to people. So I'm all for that. At the same time as keeping clarity and procedural justice in place. So I think all those are useful comments, useful suggestions, and you know that we should look into that. And wherever possible, I think to stress, as Nate was saying, you know, that there are different goals that can be met in different ways. And so, you know, kind of a narrative about that wherever possible is a really good thing. But at the same time, I also want to say that I don't run away from the term due process. It's used in many different settings. It's not only constitutionally required due process. If you're in arbitration, you know, and I do a lot of work on areas of labor arbitration, you talk about due process. You know, it's not constitutionally required. It's private process. We use the term due process. There are due process protocols for alternative dispute resolution. So it's a term of art that isn't specific only to constitutionally required due process for public institutions. So I have no problem with using a term that captures fairness and explaining it. And I don't think that we should be afraid of it. The fact that the counsel's office is concerned that we emphasize that we're a private institution is not my concern. You know, that's the counsel's office saying she has particular concerns in terms of representing the interests of the university administration in a particular way. But I think our concern can be broader than that, and that we should not be afraid to use terms that capture a notion of fairness at the same time that we can also talk about the unique nature of what we're doing here and adopting processes that fit. And that's all.
Thank you. In terms of university council, and for those who may not be aware, mm-hmm. the relationship with university council to the committee, the assembly, or the assemblies in general, they are, and they've made this very clear when they have come spoken to us, we've worked with them numerous times, but they represent the administration, they are fiduciaries to the administration, they report jointly to the president and board, and therefore that they do tirelessly advocate for what they believe is best in the interests of the university as an institution. That has occasionally brought them into friction with the assemblies, because we are, in essence, if they believe something is the best course of action, and we don't, we have advocated for that. The president has occasionally accepted our recommendations, occasionally not. But in essence, just to be clear, that university council, in this case, when they speak to this committee, it's always they're always acting on behalf of the administration, and they are not in any way for our legal team. Next, we can discuss Richard.
So, I'm going to push back really gently.
I can do.
No, I know you can. So the point about outside legal counsel being effective. Yeah, I think in many cases that's right. I think that was right in the Mr. McBride case. I think Kendall was actually more reasonable to be rich than his outside lawyer. I think it cost him a lot of money, and I wish, you know, in retrospect, I wish he hadn't done it, you know, because it did cost him a lot of money. But it's fear that led him to bring in the outside counsel, fear of punishment that he thought would significantly, strikingly change his life. And in that fear, to deny someone the choice, even if it's a bad choice, to respond as best they can to that is a mistake. So I could say, you know, yes, we could be patronizing and say, look, no legal counsel because it's not worth it to you. But I think that's the wrong way to go. I think it's looking at the wrong kind of problem. The problem here is the ace, in this case, the ace in the tree of power. senior vice provost has access to legal university counsel, has access to all of the administrative goodwill, marshalling, mobilized, and that. And to deny, that's the problem is that. So that to deny then the student the right to choose the best response they can to this situation, that's the mistake.
I don't think we're disagreeing.
I think so, okay. So, but I agree with you that the outside legal counsel in this case probably did not do any good. I mean, or, you know, I wish he hadn't been, he was very afraid. And that's what it was.
Quick question. So I want to get this straight. So was it the provost or the vice provost or
the senior vice provost charged Mitch McBride with misuse of a document?
Right. And so who was it that made the statement?
The provost.
Okay.
Wrote the letter, an open letter. It was published, you know, online the night before the hearing.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yes,
sir. I have Michelle's next on the speaker's list, but if we have a community member like to speak, I don't say it. No, okay. Ashley.
I just wanted to back up Anna's point about allowing students to have equal representation in like cases where it's two students, because I think that there's like a large power dynamic between a faculty member and any given student, where it would seem appropriate for a student to have professional representation. However, in a case of two students, you can have one student who can like afford a much better representation, and that creates another dynamic that's actually, in my opinion, worse because it privileges someone who's already privileged and does not need anything else. Secondly, I think that one of the biggest problems in this case was that the provost made an announcement, and that was another thing that changed the power dynamics, the whole entire situation. And I think that without the administration's ability to speak on behalf of themselves or on behalf of certain defendants, I think that would like also level the playing field more.
Next, I have here in the community like speak. I have heard no objections. Any objection before that? Just one thing. In terms of the counsel argument, right now counsel is allowed to be sitting on the hearings. The code explicitly allows you to send, in essence, have an advisor of your choice there as well as JCC. So the counsel is there as a quote unquote advisor. And the question, of course, would be if we were to say you're not allowed outside counsel, we cannot dictate what someone does. In theory, if you want to meet with an attorney, that is your business. Additionally, if they're just there as a quote unquote advisor, whether or not what the code doesn't look further than the idea that you're just their advisor. So that would require someone to be doing, to try and look deeper to try and figure out what's going on there. And that being said, an attorney would very likely say the executive relationship are likely privileged, but that's just something for the committee to be aware of. Manisha.
Yeah, sorry, to Richard's point, when you're talking about the power dynamic between, in this case, Mitch and the senior vice provost, I think it's important to note that the senior vice provost isn't the one who makes the decision, and it isn't the JA either who makes the decision. That's why we have the university like review board team. So I don't think that diminishes Mitch's fear, or that, you know, that I think it's still very reasonable that Mitch would be afraid when a senior vice provost put the letter out. And I think there's a question of what the appropriate response from the administration should be when there are these public hearings. I think that there needs to be an agreement maybe in the room that they shouldn't comment in the same way that the JA doesn't comment. But the reality of the situation is that the senior vice provost did not have the authority there. Even if they had university counsel telling them X, Y, Z, they didn't get to make the decision at the end of the day. At the end of the day, that went to the university review board.
The hearing board is the first level of review board's appellate, but that is semantic. Next, I have Michelle.
Just a couple of things, for Claire, if you can take back to the chairs as we're thinking about this. One of the things that's missing in the procedures is timelines for exchanges. So one of the administrative tasks that our office has to do is that we have to kind of set timelines, we go back and forth, and so if there's clear timelines, I think that would be beneficial. I think what's really interesting is that we're one of the only campuses that doesn't have an administrative process for conduct resolution. So the fact that in most colleges, an individual chooses, they go through the administrative process, which means that someone in my office would come to an agreement, they would find the level of responsibility or not, and they'd forfeit the right to appeal. It's a faster process, it's expedited. Or they would say, you know, I want a hearing board process. I want this fuller, longer, drawn-out one, which is another right that's offered, too. Every single case that comes to the office has the option to go to a hearing board, which one of the things that's really frustrating towards the end of the semester and puts a disproportionate amount of work on my staff is if we haven't heard from a student in the time that an SDA is offered, we have to move forward to a hearing, which means we have to assemble a board, do all the packets, do all the exchanges, make sure that we have a police officer off from work, that we pay double overtime, and all that's going on. And then the next day, the student signs the SDA instead of going to a hearing. So now we've also had people on the hearing board who've taken time off of work, who've lost that employment opportunity. And so that's one of the things I'd also ask is to really start to consider that if somebody doesn't sign their SDA, that it has to go to a hearing, or if there's the opportunity for an administrative process just from a university resource time. But I also really want us to think, one, I think as we're talking about restriction of speech, we need to be careful that we're not looking towards gag orders and restricting people's First Amendment rights, because there was comments in that case from both sides that was kind of even it's out that, right? We say First Amendment, you fight with First Amendment and kind of talk about that. But again, I think any kind of idea that the individuals who are participating in the process or the idea of fairness should really remain protected to that. But I want us to really, as we're thinking, moving forward with the code revisions and these changes, is why do people have fear about this system, right? I get that there's always going to be some element of scariness, right? That any time that, you know, you call to the assistant principal's office, if you go to high school or in elementary school, there's some element of fear. But I don't know if this is something that if my office doesn't come and do like a demonstration of the conversations we have with students, I don't know if it's because the only one commonality with Cornell is not wanting to get Jay. But we're moving in such a direction of, you know, restorative education. We have a mediation program with the ILR school. I know that some of this is going to take time and as that cycle goes, but I really want us to challenge, why is this so fearful? And some of it is, I think, is because it's unattainably understandable. The fact that it looks this legalistic and procedure, it's the thought that people want to have an attorney. Just on that note, too, the courts have been very clear that in any educational administrative process, an advisor is a lawyer. A student has a right to have an advisor of their choice, which includes a lawyer, but universities can choose the role of the attorney. So there's the comment that they serve as a potted plant. So they don't say anything. They can call for recess. The individual can confront them and leave. And that's something we do often. So if somebody says, you know, I have some questions for my attorney, we step out of the office, they talk with them, we come back in. And so I think kind of the hybrid between Anna and Rachel is that there's always be a role for an attorney, but we can dictate the role. And so the 6.4 process, there are much more of that potted plant because that's the best practice when it comes to educational administration. But I think it's important that they do have the right to have an attorney because there's times when it's in somebody's best interest to say, you know what, maybe you shouldn't talk about the drug deal that you just did. Maybe we just focus on the sell-in. And so there's an important balance that is struck in. And so you laugh, but it happens. And that's what we have to deal with. So I don't know how to build more trust in our process, and I don't know how to build more transparency, and I don't know how to keep talking about the movements that we're doing. Because I think whenever we say educational, people say, well, now you're getting rid of all people's rights. And that's not what it is. And so I will take any collective wisdom or ideas or suggestions on how to change that, because that's not what our office should be doing.
Thank you. I have Victoria and then Richard on the speakers. Actually, and you raised something that I think you mentioned before, but I discussed prior, which the hearing board chairs might be pushed to hear. There was concerns about the length of time it took to file the final written decision. For instance, after the hearing, once the decision is reached, the timeline, a timeline for that decision being filed, I believe there was concerns that it's been taking a concerningly long amount of time. Obviously, you need time to do so. But in essence, that was something that I know had been brought up in the past. Also, something that was brought up and discussed, oh gosh, maybe last year, there's an idea I brought forward. They have filming a quote unquote mock hearing. That's in some idea, almost say, I mean, if you look at any, again, not going to legal court, but you see mock videos of, oh, here's how things go, in essence, to try and take away that fear factor and the shock factor, and also minimize some of the repeat, the essence, the advantage of a repeat party. And that if a party's been doing this for 6 or 7 hearings, they have an inherent advantage over someone who's just walking in and going, oh, this is my first and hopefully only experience with hearing boards. So that's something that was brought up.
Do you want something like Interact? You know, are you familiar with interactive theatre? I mean, because they might do it better than,
yes.
And then you could have a video that you could
that actually, that is a phenomenal idea. I will write that down. This would require a lot of coordination and resources, but in terms of if we're looking for ways.
They are expensive, I think, but it seems to me that it's the sort of thing that might be really helpful, and they're a fantastic group. So.
That's fantastic. Thank you. And actually, I'll answer this question. I know you said you all stopped using letter adjudications. How did letter adjudications fit into the process in terms of a more expedited process?
So the previous practice that was used last year and previous and we've gotten away from because we're missing the opportunity for an educational conversation was that for first-time alcohol, drug use, and public urination cases, an individual would receive a letter that says, we received a report, we think that you're responsible for this violation, you have the right to come in to speak to a JA if you claim responsibility for this action. These would be the sanctions we would put in. Risk reprimand, alcohol, AOD, so basics for the first time, and a reflection paper. You can forego the meeting, sign this paper, and agree to do that. I got away from that because I think we're missing the opportunity because a lot of the times we have conversations with students, a lot of times we don't care about the behavior because, okay, people always drink in college. It's why. And we were missing that opportunity to really understand why the behavior was occurring. So that was how it worked. Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much. Victoria.
So to respond to one of your points, from a student perspective, any procedure at all is pretty terrifying to us because it's something that might end up on our record and that we might have to explain if we go on to certain job opportunities or to graduate school, like Richard Fryer was going to, even though he wasn't found responsible, he still has to disclose that to the law schools he's applying to. So it's one of those things where if you were able to explain that to students beforehand, like if you do this kind of behavior, this is the kind of notation that might end up on your transcript or otherwise in your written record, I think that would help them a lot.
Is there anyone? Extra Richard.
Yes. So on the fear, I mean, that in Mitch McBride case, it was probation, I think, for 6 years. And he was a graduating senior. He was going to law school. And his fear was, and I have no idea whether this is right or not, but his fear was that having on his transcript this probationary thing would nullify his admission into law school. This is a fear, but it's not paranoia. It's a fear. It was a fear. And the second thing is, yes, you know, and I think this is right, but Michelle, you can tell me, if you get an unreasonable complaint and someone presses it forward regardless, does it go to the hearing board regardless? Then in that case, it doesn't matter. You know, here's the senior vice provost who files the case, and whether or not the OGA likes it or not or thinks it's appropriate or not, they can press it forward. So it's not the case that they're, this is, here are the two principles that I think, and this will be, for me, this is true throughout the code. On one hand, I want all members of the university community to be on an equal footing underneath the code, that we all have rights, we all have responsibilities, we're all the same. So the installation of staff, of the provost, which I think served Hines behind staff when he writes this letter, I find this really, really awful. This is part of employment. So I'd like to get rid of that kind of option. That's down the line, that's not dealing with you, but it's dealing with how the University Hearing Board fits into a complex that in which power relations between the administration and students are just overwhelming. So the Hearing Board at least should be sensitive to that problem.
Thank you, Richard. Next, I have Michelle.
I have Nate. Also, knowing that we have run over time, so if questions, obviously, the rest of our agenda primarily we can compress, and I suspect also knew this might occur, but just to be aware of the timing. Next is Michelle.
I just want to explain the notation. So probation is not notated on any transcripts. It's reportable, but it's not notated. So there's a distinction. That's a university registrar. And so what the show causes, so what that means is somebody comes to our office and says, like, I want to file a complaint against Michelle because I hate people from Detroit. I'm like, oh, I like Detroit. I think it's cool. We as an office would say, you know, there's no grounds for that complaint. There's no code violation that says that that's something that we bring charges against. That individual then has the right to show cause. And I actually think the show cause is a really nice check and balance on the J's power. I actually, this is the first institution that I've ever seen that, and I really appreciate it. I think it's good. And there's only been one instance in the past 2 years that the hearing board has said, you know what, we want you to relook into this case. And so we had a show cause where we just had to reopen an investigation. And we had to reopen it for a few reasons, one of which we didn't provide enough information because we had some privacy concerns. But usually the hearing boards get that right, and it's a paper hearing. So the parties are involved. There just has to be a couple of written documents. That's not usually a huge burdensome process. So I just wanted to kind of explain that since it came up.
And just if you're curious, the procedures are on the middle of page 4 on the hearing board packet. Mm-hmm. And just briefly, in terms of some of the concerns that Mitch just spoke about when he was going through this, he actually asked me a few times for just information and just frankly, I dare say advice, but in essence, his concern was when you're applying to law school, actually knowing there's a number of law students or lawyers in the room, you have to file, in essence, a release with the Office of the Administrator, in essence, that any record of disciplinary infractions would be sent along, and the concern was, in essence, that would happen, and that wouldn't necessarily, unless it was a suspension or expulsion, it wouldn't necessarily get rise low of being annotated on the transcript, but it would in essence be disclosable. And having colleagues of mine who are now in the consulting and finance sectors, those industries as well, actually MBA programs as well, follow that kind of idea. Actually, MBA programs are stricter than law schools, which is surprising. They actually have a third-party auditor audit your resume. But in essence, the same idea that disclosure for some industries, especially those that are quote-unquote trying to change their image, which is finance, it's been some people, my colleagues, have said it's the scarlet letter, and that in terms of should you do anything wrong in the future, that would be used as a basis for a lawsuit. Oh, you shouldn't have hired X, Y, or Z. So that's why there was, I think that was part of the concern. Mitch actually was in some of the conversations where that happened. I know I was there as well. And I believe that's part of the reason his concerns were grounded in that, specifically also his concern about his mission. And actually, because not everyone may be aware, Mr. Brad, I'm very happy to report, is at law school. I'm sure he may be scared right now, but I suspect it's for a different reason. That would be because he's a first-year law student coming up on his first round of exams, which for the law students and lawyers, they know that would be, I'm sure he'll be happy when those are over. But in terms of this story ended in a way that he has moved on to his next endeavor, and as far as I know, is doing well. Next, I have Nate.
So maybe one of the problems, and I think one of the problems specifically, Richard, that you're talking about is that the code doesn't cover administrators. And I have mixed feelings about that myself. I really do feel like everybody who's affiliated with the university should be held to the same standards of behavior. On the other hand, I've also worked in HR, and I know that often HR strictures are stricter than what's in the code of conduct. And it would be clunky to have to procedurally put everybody under the same umbrella. So, like, that's tough. But I agree with you that it's frustrating that we don't have, like a Bivens remedy for administrators. Like, it would be great to be able to say, hey, Senior Vice Provost, you've meddled in this, and we're going to, you know, basically JA you in your individual capacity rather than in your official capacity for misusing your official capacity. That's sort of a colorable offing. And hopefully we can get a remedy that wasn't as undercut as Bivens has been.
Sorry, point of information, you just spoke a lot of law students.
Oh, yeah, okay, so basically Bivens means you can sue government agents for being awful to you in their individual capacities. And so, crucially, it provides an individual remedy for people who have been mistreated by officials because, like, what would you do? Like, jade the university administration? Like, that's obviously not feasible. And so I don't know if there are sort of jurisdictional ways that we could answer that power imbalance and hold people responsible in their individual capacities. But I think probably the easier thing to do would be for the UA to ask the administration to please not comment on pending JAs.
Or take it in, which I think would be a better remedy than asking the president. The resolution should have condemned the provost's intervention in this case. There are three kinds of, being really simplistic, there are three kinds of situations here. There are student to student, there are staff to staff, and there are staff to student. The staff to student one is of immediate concern in this case. And that's the one where, yes, so we're gonna judge them by and give them different rights by different standards. It's something we have to think about, in the months to come. But it is a real problem to insulate someone who's already overwhelmingly powerful, to insulate them from the very standards. So in Mitch's case, a senior administrator can prosecute him, but he cannot turn around and say, you have violated my rights as well. The asymmetry there is just a real problem. In a university community, it breeds cynicism, I think legitimate, cynicism, justified cynicism about the justice of the of behaviors, about the way the institution works. So it's something. It is a serious something. Now, staff to staff, you decide to leave that where it is. Student to student, some change. Leave that. It's staff student that I think was the real problem in this case. And so the legitimate concern.
And I think as we're kind of thinking about some of those points, because I agree there are some really strong inequities, and I think even when we look at the difference between staff and supervisory staff, tenured and untenured faculty, I think we need to be very careful with that. I think one of the things when we think about systems, we need to look at the cross complaints and what those look like. And I also think we need to look at venue, right? And Matthew was saying the same thing, that just because it can't be resolved in one environment doesn't mean it can't be done the other. And I want to point out that our faculty and staff actually hold themselves to a higher standard of proof, because for HR policies, you only need to meet the preponderance of evidence. And so our faculty and staff are actually being held to a higher standard than our students are, because our students have to, or any incident under the code, has to meet that clear and convincing. So one of the reasons that we see such few faculty and staff cases are not only because most of the behavior occurs in the workplace, and most faculty and staff are over 21, so when they're consuming alcohol, they're doing so in a legal way. But I think if we're going to be talking about that, we really need to look at, if we're holding ourselves to a consistent standard, are we going to hold ourselves to what level of standard?
Thank you. That has exhausted the speakers list. Are there any final comments or questions? Seeing none, thank you so much, Claire. We appreciate you taking the time. I hope you found some things that are useful.
Stay fairly quiet because. I mean, that's okay. And I certainly agree with, personally, with most of the comments, but I think it wasn't appropriate for me to comment this on specific case, and so it wasn't actually.
Absolutely. Well, thank you. So please join me in thanking Professor Hugh Brown.
Thank you for all you
do. Well, thank you. We really appreciate it. It's been an absolute pleasure. Like I said, we'll hopefully have the hearing boards, the other hearing board chairs, the administrative review and hearing board chairs in the spring, when they can, so we can have a robust discussion. I appreciate you taking that back. I hope we really do appreciate what you do. I hope we weren't coming across as otherwise.
I've learned a lot too, so
thank you very much. I appreciate it. Thank you very much. Have a great day. Thank you. Thank you, everyone. Also, as a reminder, we have pizza. Please feel free to help yourselves, including guests. Next on our agenda is the hearing board, hearing review board staffing updates that will be very brief, thankfully. We've discussed it quite a bit. The questions are still attached. I was working in terms of trying to find a way to make number, I believe, 11, verify, a December 11th, a more clear hypothetical. We had an idea where we were just playing around with some form of color, or I like put it there later, like you can't wear a certain color clothing because something that's so, it illustrates ambiguity, but it would never actually hopefully be in the code, is to provide some idea. We're working with that. In terms of the actual procedure, I am meeting with the Office of the Assemblies next Monday to discuss a time, and attempt to finalize a timeline to get this underway. What we will do is, the rough idea is start something the first week back, have the applications open for 2 weeks, after which the committee will then come back and we will determine how we've done. And after that, hold, maybe in this case, because we're meeting weekly, maybe extra meetings or some other way to have individuals who are interested and able to review the applications. We do not have a rank on 1.1 to a 5-point scale, we'll rank the list, determine the number of vacancies we anticipate. And because we're doing this early, there was talk that we might also, if necessary, we can hold interviews with other candidates. And so once you rank certain candidates number five, we have five quote-unquote top quality candidates, but only 3 or 4 seats. We can then decide if we want to do interviews or proceed appropriately. Our intent is to be ahead of schedule and be more responsive this year, especially as we're trying to update the campus code of conduct to ensure that our procedures actually reflect the policies as written. Are there any questions? Actually, Michelle's on speakers list, but are there any other questions on this? Please let me know, and I'll switch on speakers list.
The only thing, and usually I step out of the room, but you guys weren't talking about anything substantive here, but as you're looking at ranking individuals, if you guys could focus on the procedure to notify individuals, because we've had about 15 vacancies over the past 2 years, and the process to that is just so slow and cumbersome. So if there's, as you're looking at this process of ranking and having alternates, considering, do the alternates get trained? So right away, if there's a vacancy, they can go right now. So for example, we have a hearing board member who just took a job at Penn, so she's even now we have an opening. So if y'all can kind of codify that too, that'd be really helpful.
Thank you. And Nate is next.
Moved by unanimous consent to extend the meeting time by 5 minutes.
Great consent. Hearing none. Okay, the meeting is extended until 5:50. Pardon. Thank you. And I somehow have my head starting at 6. Okay, so that, are there any other comments or questions about the hearing board staffing? I will note that there is a, in essence, for the filling of vacancies. I know the UA tried to fill a number of vacancies, or we did fill a number of vacancies in the beginning of the semester. I can speak to offline if there's any more that are coming up to try and find a formal way to do that. That being said, that leads us to the hate speech working group based discussion, which I suspect we will conclude with. That the hate speech working group, and I'm sure Nate will have plenty to add, we had a digital reset, thank you. We had a meeting on Monday. It was a productive meeting. It was the first meeting. In terms of, there were a number of things discussed, but in terms of logistics, we are staffed, except we're currently waiting on the employee assembly. I've spoken with Mr. Jeremy Cruiser, executive vice chair of the employee assembly and vice chair for internal operations at the UA. He is currently finding two employee or staff members for us. We had a faculty member who was appointed, I want to say 2 days ago, and then we're currently in the student assembly. I've been told they will hopefully be appointing someone at their meeting on Thursday or shortly thereafter. I'm currently attempting to find a time for another meeting. I've sent out an availability poll. We're waiting on a few more people. I can circulate that meeting to anyone who's interested. And actually, I probably will send it around the listserv just so we have everyone's aware. At the meeting on Monday, we discussed general timelines and logistics in terms of looking at, in order to have something to the UA for time and consideration, for time to the president to look at. In essence, the bulk of the work would have to be done by the end of February, which is why we're looking at having forms the second week of class back. There was an idea of having multiple forms that week, potentially also having forms every 2 weeks thereafter, since they'd be beginning, middle, end, or beginning, middle, middle, end, whatever would work, to attempt to do that. For the forms, there's talk of finding, in essence, finding other policies that might, other universities' policies that might be emblematic of various approaches, including a procedure for what a speech code could look like, how you could have, in essence, guidelines just for enforcement, essence to look at the existing procedure and enforce that. Well, something similar to the appendices that we've discussed potentially have right context of the code. Other items such as reasons why you shouldn't have one, essence to provide a path to community why there are 3 or 4 ice buckets forward without trying to say here's what anyone has agreed to, but essence to try and bound the discussion, as I think we've seen here, I think our discussions can go in circles very easily to essence say here are 4 different areas and potentially also even 4 different examples of things that are similar to this to try and solicit community input, have that discussion, and then have their internal discussion and talk to the UA, or talk to this committee, and then talk to the CDC, and talk to the UA, sorry, and then move forward. And also, we will be having also, I'm working with the office to ensure we have adequate room sizes and that we will be able to accommodate a large group of people, and we will move forward from there. Nate, raise everything you'd like to add, please. Feel free to jump in. Nate?
Yeah, real quick, I've sort of taken on the tech side of things. We have a listserv now if you want to be on it. It probably won't really do anything other than talk about our meeting times until like next semester, realistically. And we're working on a web page hosted on the Assembly's web page that is shamelessly, with his permission, ripping off Charlie Van Loan's like CRPC and calendar committee style of hopefully clear, concise, well-organized, plentiful information. So if folks have feedback on that, I will let this committee as well as the ad hoc know when that's live. Feedback would be appreciated.
Thank you, Richard. I apologize. The listserv should be up and running. There are a bunch of test emails going out today, so we are should be up on that. I have Michelle and Richard. Do you want to introduce this list?
What? Yes.
Excuse me, can I just, I have to go.
Of course.
Really sorry about that. I just wanted to mention that, you know, one of the things we've been talking about is to make sure that even as we're having these organizing meetings to get up and running of the committee, that we need to make sure that they are public as well, so that whatever we need to do to publicize the fact that we're having organizational type meetings
yes.
will be important to do.
Oh, yes, tell your assemblies.
Yes, I will also, the meeting will be sent to us. I'll send it out to the CJC's info listserv as well. Any, please share it widely. Once we have a time for the next meeting, that will also be, hopefully we got the final response today and we'll be able to get that going. I have Michelle and then Richard. And also actually we are, if there's any dissent,
sure, I'll move again to
yes,
the
5 minutes. Thank you, Michelle.
Yeah, if there's like any posters or publicity that y'all were planning, you know, that'd be really helpful. That would just kind of slap on office doors and stuff like that. But when you're talking about the four buckets, is it kind of the idea to give everybody who attends these forums common speaking, common knowledge to have a base conversation from? Or is it the idea that here's option one, here's option two, here's option three, here's option four?
Kind of some of both. The idea is to provide some background knowledge and also just to organize the possibilities, right? Like one of the things we can do is make no changes, right? So that's kind of like a bucket. That's an area. You know, that's like one kind of decision we can make. Another kind of decision we can make is say, look, the code's fine, but we need to recommend some enforcement changes, right? Changes in enforcement. And then another thing we could say is, well, we want to change the code. And then if we want to change the code, how are we going to change it? You know, with that is a more complicated bucket that might deserve some buckets, but you know, that's all we're talking about, just very kind of roughly, you know, change nothing, change enforcement, change language, and then how will we change language, maybe give like two different ideas, you know, do we want to think of this as a harassment via speech thing, which the Black Law Students Association language was picking up on putting some speech language into the harassment section. You know, do we want to take more of a speechy stance, you know, where... but just like very, very rough areas of the conceptual space.
The ideas everyone was brought forward was to try and always have a tabula rasa, a blank slate, in essence, to say that no one has decided this is what will be done. But that being said, as was seen with the presidential working group or presidential task force and their early meetings, in essence, a way to frame the discussion to provide information, because obviously if you're going to talk about doing nothing, the question of course is, well, what do we do now? What does the code already have? To provide information so people can have that discussion. And that's why there's even multiple forms, written comments and the like, to ensure that we are able to, for instance, there's an intelligent discussion and also people know in essence what the realm of possibility is. And obviously I think the fourth bucket also is something else never considered. It's always, people come up with the most brilliant, even the idea of interactive theater, the ideas that when you talk to people you come up with are generally can be amazing. That's why the idea doesn't say we haven't bounded it, and also to not even provide our own language, because then people would say, oh, why did you come up with this language? But provide, and it's emblematic of X institution. Here's what they did. We found this. It's almost an idea, something that we could look at to try and show the various paths without saying that we have quote unquote put the cart before the ox, and we're already done. Because I think that's something that the community would not take kind of to, and it also would not be inclusive into trying to get their input. I have Richard. I think that'll likely round us out.
So Nate, why don't you put us all on the listserv? I mean, all the members of the committee, the CJC.
Richard.
You said if you want to be on the listserv, to let you know, but why don't you just put all the members?
Oh, yes, no, we're planning on having the CJC list be on be a recipient of the ad hoc list.
Okay,
what
so
I'm saying,
don't
saying is, sorry, promulgate to your assembly is the opportunity to be on this listserv to stay abreast of updates.
You're set.
So everyone in this room right now is set. Absolutely. So that would be Risa, Nate, and Connor from this committee. We have Aaron L. Sabrut from the GPSA, a professor whose name is actually, I'll just verify, I have it written down, a professor, who I'm going to tell you, is a professor in the who studies colonialism, gender studies, and other related areas. I remember saying, pulled his bio because I was curious. His name is Professor Suman Seth. He's appointed by the Faculty Senate. And then we have two employees who are vacant. We have one undergrad student seat who is vacant, and that is the current formally appointed membership of the committee. That being said, as we said before, it's open to anyone. The intent is to make it as wide as possible, which is why I've been working with the office to make sure we have rooms that are large enough to accommodate a substantial crowd. If should someone choose to
take the official membership is fine.
It will be 8 when it's all said and done.
When it's done,
yes.
Right now it's fine.
Right. Are there any other comments or questions? We're pretty close to time. Hearing none, are there any motions to adjourn?
I'll move.
Is there a second? Any dissent? Hearing none, meeting adjourned. The time is 5:55, right on time. Thank you very much, everyone. I hope everyone has a safe holidays. Depending on what you celebrate, Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, Happy Kwanzaa, Happy New Year, and or something else I may have missed. Thank you very much.
There's Ramadan this year.
I don't know what Ramadan is.
No, it's tied to the lunar calendar, so it moves around the year. It sucks in summer because the days are too long.
So
the chair should only vote if somebody else is abstaining. And the structure is from one member, one person, 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 one person,